This is Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for listening today. Through the end of next week, we're focusing attention on issues surrounding race relations in Milwaukee during our series called Project Milwaukee, Black and White. Yesterday on the program, we looked back at the early history of the black-white racial dynamic in Milwaukee, from the time the city was settled through the Second World War. Today on Lake Effect, we have three remarkable views of the civil rights era here. We should note that some of those accounts include language that was offensive then and remains offensive to many today. If you had just met Margaret Rozga, you wouldn't expect that this seemingly quiet, unassuming, and white woman would have had a front-row seat in the fights against housing and employment discrimination and other civil rights issues in the 1960s and 70s. But Rozga, who is now an English professor at the University of Wisconsin-Waukesha, actually had more than a front-row seat. She was an active participant. While she studied at Alverno College, Rozga was drawn into the movement by its iconic local leader, Father James Groppi. There was such a strong connection between the two that after Groppi left the priesthood, they were married. Years later, Rozga still fights to keep problems of social inequity on the radar screen in Milwaukee. She was an organizer of the 40th anniversary March on Milwaukee 2 years ago, and she was a key source in the recent book by the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's Patrick Jones, called The Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee. Jones and Rozga joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke for a discussion on the civil rights period here and its legacy. Rozga talked about how one of the ugliest periods in Milwaukee's history could also be one of the most constructive for her.
It certainly was the turning point of my life. I grew up on the south side of Milwaukee, and I was raised on 44th in Oklahoma, a very homogeneous neighborhood, all white, mostly Catholic. I think there was one family across the street that sent their children to public school, so we were mostly Catholic and one public. And the civil rights movement introduced me to a multiracial, multicultural group of friends. And ever since then, I can't imagine living any other way. And it has become what I live for. And I don't know that I call that good or bad, but it certainly is important to me.
Why did that happen at first for you? There you were living in this relatively, not even relatively, almost completely homogenous neighborhood, largely Catholic, and as you say, few people even going to public schools there. Why you and not everybody else around you?
Sometimes I ask myself that question when I think back on the kind of religious training that I had. It seems to me just a logical follow-through. I remember singing songs like "An Army of Youth Fighting Standards of Truth," "The Cross Our Only Sword," and it seemed to me that we were being taught certain principles, and then when the civil rights movement came along, this was an opportunity to implement those principles.
You're saying these songs almost had different meaning to you than everybody else that was singing them, even though they were the same words.
Maybe that's what happened. I have a student who did a research project on what motivated people who got involved in the civil rights struggle. And what she found was that the students were not different in their basic orientation, but there was a difference in terms of their willingness to go from conviction into action. And so I think that's probably where I fit.
This is kind of emblematic about what was happening within the Catholic Church as a whole as Father Groppi was coming up through the priesthood, was it not? There was almost, if not a literal split, there were certainly things going on within the Catholic Church as it was playing out in the inner city and in the suburbs.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. The 1960s in general are a time of great turmoil and change within the Catholic Church. And on the one hand, Father Groppi represents, and there are many others, both religious people, priests, nuns, but also lay people who are in this vein, but that were coming out of more of a reform tradition in the church, involved with Catholic action movements, involved with the Cardine movement, which was very strong here in Milwaukee. And then this kind of culminated with the Second Vatican Councils and the reforms there. And again, as Peggy said, that then for many of these folks, and Father Groppi talked about this often, that the civil rights movement seemed to embody that promise of the church. Now, on the other hand, you had the bulk of local Catholics, white ethnic working class Catholics who were more rooted in a traditional form of Catholicism, and there was great tension between those, and that fissure opened up during the 1960s, and in many ways it remains unresolved today. It's not just something within the Catholic Church, although it perhaps is most dramatic within that institution, but Protestant denominations felt the same schism open up, Jewish congregations as well. And we'd call that today the beginning of the culture wars or something like that that have animated our culture over the last 40 years.
Well, and for people who aren't as familiar with who Father Grappi was, his childhood was not all that dissimilar from yours. He came from a pretty homogenous neighborhood. He was from Bayview, right?
That's correct. The family home was attached to the Grappi grocery store on the corner of Wentworth and Russell, and that's where he grew up, went to Bayview High School.
Mm-hmm. It was one thing, though, for him even to go into the priesthood and have these strong moral convictions, but how did he go from that point to leading, for example, the NAACP's Youth Council? This is a pretty remarkable story.
Well, he was told by the archdiocese when he was assigned to St. Boniface that he should work on conversions. So he went door to door, passing out Catholic literature, asking people if they wanted to join the church. And one of the homes he went to was the Harris family, whose daughters were all very active in the NAACP Youth Council. And they said, come on in, sit down. Oh, yes. Well, how would you like to get involved with the civil rights movement? At that time, the NAACP Youth Council was looking for an advisor. And so he did that. But he had been the director of a day camp in the Hillside Project area as a seminarian and was pretty committed to working in the inner city from that point on.
Mm-hmm. Can you put into perspective what it meant to have somebody who was not only white but in the priesthood at the center of this to the movement? I mean, what additional significance did both of those facts attach?
Well, I think it was tremendously important for a lot of different reasons. One, within the context of the church, because the Catholic Church is hierarchical and obedience to authority is so crucial, that a priest is such a central figure. So you had Father Grappi, born on the South Side, now living on the North Side and advocating for civil rights for African Americans. And as a white Catholic priest, that was significant for the white community, particularly Catholics, because many whites have a tendency to dismiss African-American leaders, to say, oh, well, that's just an African-American, and that's not one of us. But here you had a white person and a Catholic priest, a person of honor and authority to many, advocating vigorously for racial justice. It was harder for some to ignore that call than it would be to dismiss the calls coming from the African-American community. Now, on the other side of the racial line, that's complicated because a white Catholic priest comes to be the center of media attention, the lightning rod around which much of this is happening. And as central and as important as Father Grappi is, there were also dozens and dozens of other local people who were active and important to this struggle as well. But there's no doubt about it, the fact that he's a white Catholic priest alters the dynamics in critical and important ways.
When did you first meet Father Grappi?
I volunteered to work on a voter registration project, a Southern Christian Leadership Conference-sponsored project. There were eight of us from Milwaukee. We were going to be working in Bullock County, Alabama. It's about 50 miles southeast of Montgomery.
And you were at El Verno at that point, correct?
I was a student at El Verno, right. This was shortly after the Selma to Montgomery march, and people who had been involved in that march came to recruit for the project to El Verno and elsewhere in Milwaukee. So eight of us volunteered. We had lots of enthusiasm and lots of good intentions. We didn't have any money and we didn't have any car. One of the other volunteers knew Father Grappi, and he said, and this was right around the time that he had been arrested the first time. He was blocking school buses that were busing for segregation. And this is an episode in Milwaukee history that tends to be forgotten. There was a point at which the Milwaukee School Board was taking black children from inner city schools, busing them out to schools in the surrounding area, white schools in the city of Milwaukee where there were empty classrooms, keeping them separate in separate classrooms, having a separate recess, and sometimes put back on the bus at noon, sent back to the sending school where they had lunch, and then after lunch they were put back on the bus and sent back out to the receiving school. So they were doing four trips a day. Black parents were outraged. So the issue became, if you're going to be busing our children, then bus them for integration, integrate them when they get to the school. So he had been arrested blocking a school bus on that issue. It was the first time in the city of Milwaukee that a white Catholic clergy person had been arrested, and there was a furor. So Tim, one of the people in our group, said, I know somebody who'd probably like to get out of town. And that turned out to be Father Grappi. So that's how we met, driving down south while I was a volunteer to work on a voter registration project.
What was that drive like? I mean, there's Milwaukee, and then there's whatever it was, must have been a 20-hour drive or multiple-day drive.
An integrated group traveling in a car at that point didn't really feel free to stop. This is actually after the Civil Rights Bill of 1964 has passed, but it still is iffy about finding accommodations. And we didn't have much money. So we drove straight through, but we all could drive, so we would take turns, and then we went to Atlanta for the orientation. It was an interesting drive.
I can bet. And how fresh is that in your mind? Can you still remember what your initial impressions of this man were?
I can. We didn't stay on the main roads all the way. We went on some back roads. He wanted us to see the rural South. He wanted us to see the shacks that people were living in. He wanted to stop in roadside grocery stores. That's where we would buy, you know, a loaf of bread and some lunch meat and make sandwiches to eat. He had previously been at St. Veronica's Church, and I went to St. Mary's Academy. A lot of my classmates had been parishioners at St. Veronica's Church. So a lot of the conversation was, do you remember Terry Balistrieri? Do you remember, you know, so on and so forth. So that was the bond that began to build the friendship long term.
Margaret Rozga is the widow of Milwaukee civil rights leader James Grappi and a veteran of the civil rights movement herself. We'll continue our conversation with her and author Patrick Jones in just a moment. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Let's get back to Mitch Tyke's conversation with Patrick Jones, author of The Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee, and Margaret Rozga, widow of civil rights leader Father James Grappi. Mitch Tyke asked Rozga whether she's able to pass some of the most notorious sites of the local struggle for civil rights today without thinking of her experiences more than 40 years ago.
I'm always doing informal tours of Milwaukee. This is where this happened. This is where that happened. And in fact, I'd like to see a map of the city that is Milwaukee civil rights. A lot of places in the South have decided that they will come to terms with their racial past. And one of the ways that they do it is to say, yes, this happened here. Yes, this is important. Yes, this should be remembered. And the Chamber of Commerce promotes it as something to do when you're in the city. And I think that's something that would be healthy for Milwaukee to do.
Patrick Jones, as a chronicler of the history of that era, what is it like to see these places existing today? I mean, it must almost be a little surreal to be able to drive by a place that was such the center for such hate, I guess, or controversy or a collision of worlds, and it's just another spot on the map today.
Sure. Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, there's no doubt that if you experience this and were a participant, or if, like me, a scholar of this time period and spending so much time thinking about it and delving into the sources, that you can't help but see ghosts all around and experience this history even today. And you also can't help but see the continuing inequality in our city, the shameful continuing inequality and nexus of race and poverty in Milwaukee today. And so in that regard, some things haven't changed. In terms of other things, the Eagles Club, for instance, when I was living here several years back, one of the first things I did, I went to see a music concert, and it was a reggae band. And it was all African-Americans and Jamaicans. And it was at the Eagles Club. It was at the Rave. And I had this great experience there thinking of the various people turning over in their grave with the Eagles Club having a concert that was, you know, 75% African-Americans. And at the same time, those who had been a part of this struggle rejoicing at this change. So there have been some changes. You know, the 16th Street Viaduct is named for Father Grappi today. Though I think all of these things, I would underscore what Peggy said, that I think this history history needs to be embraced by the city and memorialized and explored and learned, not just to recover our past, but because I think this past is really important to helping us understand the persistent inequalities in the community today and to help us think more in a more complicated and subtle and effective way about what we might need to do to overcome these persistent inequalities. So it's a critical history, and it's a great idea to have a historical or a heritage tour about the movement here, because the movement isn't just significant locally. Milwaukee is a significant place nationally in the movement history. It's been forgotten in the public mind, but that's one of the things that I'm trying to do, and younger historians are trying to do, recover these northern stories and insert them back into the national narrative of the struggle for racial justice. And Milwaukee has an important place. Father Grappi is an important figure. The movement here played an important role in the passage of the 1968 Civil Rights Act, which was a fair housing law as well. And so that's a history that's fraught with tragedy and the persistent inequality today, but it's also a history that should be celebrated by this community and that this community should take pride in, I think, as well, not only for the transformation and the contributions here, but for the transformations and the contributions that the struggle here made to the entire nation.
And especially for the young people in the city, I think we get our sense of what is possible by what is our sense of history. And if the courageous action of Milwaukee teenagers 42 years ago now is forgotten, then young people today have no model that they can use for their own civic involvement.
Most citizens, but particularly young people, they have a sense that there's inequality and there are all these issues and difficulties that we face. What they don't have a sense of is what they can do about it. It's oftentimes my college students feel overwhelmed when they're opened up to the various inequalities and things in society. And what this story and these kinds of stories teach us is about democracy and citizenship, and that ordinary people can make extraordinary change.
We hear the word segregation applied not just to historical times, but also used to describe Milwaukee today. What do you think segregation really means today, and how does it relate to historical movements like school integration and housing discrimination or fair housing laws? What is the segregation that people talk about when they apply it to Milwaukee today? What does that mean?
I think it means that we are not yet a multicultural, multiracial, multiethnic society, that we too often fear each other and try to avoid each other. I think it's the product of a long process of constructing a society that is segregated. The house that I grew up in, when my father died and we were cleaning out the closets, found the original deed to our house, and on it was written, any attempt to sell this property to a person of Negro descent shall be considered null and void. So there were restrictive covenants. The segregation was the product of policy decisions on the part of businesses and cooperation of the government to allow it to happen. And it's going to take a while to deconstruct what was so long in construction. But I think that we have to make a determination to take those steps and to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what segregation means today, we can look at inequality, race and inequality, along a variety of factors, and we can still see gross discrepancies between the white and black community, whether it's in education, whether it's in housing, whether it's in employment, whether it's in levels of wealth accumulation, you know, across the board, there are still shameful levels. And in fact, if we look at the 1960s, there were the major gains that came of the 1960s happened in the 1970s. By the end of the 1970s, they began to diminish. And since about 1980 and the rise of Ronald Reagan, and we've seen the rise of a new conservatism over the last 30 or 40 years, those gains have really not continued to expand, and in fact have gone the opposite direction. In the last 10, 15 years, for instance, public schools across the country, but also here, have resegregated, for instance. And so we can look at a lot of just measurable factors. And we have to put it in this historical trajectory. One of the things that the movement was unable to do, and many white folks were unable to wrap their brains and around, was the need to attack the link between race and poverty, particularly in our urban centers. That's something we've never done effectively. We've never in our entire history had an effective, meaningful policy to attack urban inequality. The programs that we had in the 1960s were fleeting. They were mainly underfunded. Vietnam quickly overcame them money-wise, and then this new conservatism also undercut them as well. So it's the great unlived, unrealized dream, if we want to use the language of Dr. King. There's also just a kind of alienation between people, too. The majority of white people interact mainly with other white people. That's not true for people of color because they have to engage with the dominant society. But we live in very separate ways. We have very separate experiences. When we do that, then people are unable to make sense of the world that they live in. It's not that people don't realize that the northern part of Milwaukee is disproportionately poor and African American. It's that they don't have a way to think about it mainly that makes sense of it and that hooks them into the story in any way. They don't feel any kind of sense of responsibility for the creation of this, let alone the solutions that would need to be marshaled to overcome these persistent inequalities. And so we have a lot of work, but when we're so isolated from each other and then we only get information through the media, which is so distorted even today when it comes to race, or just silent on these crucial issues, and I don't know if you tell your story. This is important.
I want to tell that story. When Barack Obama was elected president, it was an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the celebration in the Black community, and it began with this phrase: 41 years ago, riots rocked the city of Milwaukee. And I was outraged. Riots, plural. You know, in one sense, that's true. You know, I will grant that there was a riot on 3rd Street, African Americans upset about the conditions that they were living in. But if you're going to make that riots plural, then you have to acknowledge that there was a white riot on the South Side when the NAACP Youth Council marched to Kosciuszko Park. And when you say the word riot, most people don't think of white people out of control, white people being violent. And so that sentence, that word, reinforces stereotypes about Blacks as being violent and makes people fearful and works against coming together.
I think, too, that there's an aspect that many whites feel kind of put on or exhausted by race. And we get this kind of rhetoric of, let's just get beyond race, or they say, I don't see race, or something like that. And part of that comes from, I think, most white folks are used to when there's a problem raising their voice and somebody responding and acting, right? And so they want an immediate solution. So let's acknowledge race and let's be done with it so we can get back to the reality of life or something like that, which is a gross misunderstanding of what the problems are and what it will take to overcome them, but also a clear indication of the racial privilege that many whites live under in a city like Milwaukee, but also across the country, not having to deal with these issues unless they choose to deal with these issues. And so that brings up an important role, is that we need to marshal political will. We need to tell these stories. We need to recover this history. We need to have these conversations to change the mindset, the consciousness in a community, so that we all feel a responsibility to not just our street, but to the whole metropolitan area, and understanding that there's an interconnection between affluent white suburbs and depressed urban communities of color. They're not distinct and separate, but they're intertwined in the history together in the public policy that enables and creates those things. That plays into the media and its role, as well as schools and education and opening up spaces for conversations like the one we're having today.
And I think these conversations are necessary, and sometimes they're inhibited because people are fearful of saying the wrong thing or not having the right vocabulary at their command. And I think we have to begin to struggle through that. Mm-hmm. Okay, I may say the wrong thing, and if I do, please tell me. And once I'm aware of it, I will make an effort not to do it anymore, or at least understand why it's offensive. But let's begin to talk and let's forgive each other for stumbling a little bit and see where we can go.
Well, I think we've started the conversation today. Peggy Rosga and Patrick Jones, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Margaret Rosga is a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin, Waukesha. She was married to the late civil rights leader James Groppi from the time he left the priesthood in 1976 until his death in 1985. Patrick Jones is an assistant professor of history and ethnic studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the author of The Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee, published by Harvard University Press. Margaret Rosga continues to be involved in issues of social inequity. She's also published a collection of poems about the fight for open housing. We'll get another firsthand account of the civil rights era in Milwaukee next. Frank Aukofer covered the period of great racial unrest for the Milwaukee Journal. We'll hear his recollection of that era coming up next on Lake Effect.